One of my favorite movies, many people's favorite movie at Christmas time is It's a Wonderful Life. And there's a scene in there before George meets the angel where he's at home and he's going upstairs and he grabs like the kind of banister and the little thing comes off, you know, the banister. He pulls it and it's loose. Does anybody remember that scene? You know, and it's like pissed, like damn, you know. And then after he's, you know, worked with the angel and, realizes, then it comes off still, but he's delighted, right? You know, it's like cool, okay, like that, right? Yeah, he kisses it. That's right. So that's the way I feel about the door and back. So the door, the latch doesn't get fixed, and then every time the AC comes on, then it kind of, like opens up a little bit. So, you know, I have to do what's called mind training or transformation, Lojong, and go, oh, that's really cool, the door. is still like doing its thing, like that. however, I can delight in it and still like ask Eric to shut it, right? Eric? Yeah. yeah. Yeah, and Peter will be fixing it, you know, too. And then I'll be on to something else that's irritating and delightful, you know, like that. Yeah, that's the whole difference there. So we're talking about Medicine Buddha, right? This September, next month, we'll be having a sand mandala of Medicine Buddha constructed here at the Gompa in the temple by Geshe Sawang and his team. They will be here, I think, starting actually 9/11, Tuesday the 11th is our date. Yeah, so, and then that weekend, Sunday the 16th, we have Kenshin Rinpoche who will be giving the Medicine Buddha initiation, the introduction and the teaching about the practice. So we'll be, you know, formally mailing out announcement on that, but I wanted to start teaching on that. So even though Kenshin Rinpoche will be saying things and hope Sawang Rinpoche will too, then we can get ready. We have, two blue Buddhas right out on the front of the building, right? It's a color of blue of Medicine Buddha. It's a healing color. Sometimes very dark blue, sometimes a little lighter like we see in the building. Generally, it's lapis lazuli is the color like that. We do Medicine Buddha practice here Friday, maybe one Friday a month. It's one, you know, maybe if we have volunteers, we can move it to doing it twice, right? We'll see. We'll see who comes up. You know, somebody goes, well, I'm doing the practice anyway, so how about if I do it? So someone I'm hoping will appear that will be inspired as a result of the sand mandala and the initiation. Because after all, that's one of the big purposes of doing a ceremony and seeing a mandala being built is you get inspired, right? That's, you know. So we have a fancy word, wankur, that's translated as empowerment, but people sometimes get kind of grandiose with that, you know. So it really means like being inspired in a connected way, not inspired in a disconnect, inspired in a connected way that you want to do a practice to benefit others. So I'm looking forward to us doing doing more medicine Buddha practice here. The formal practice is not what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about the general idea of medicine Buddha and healing. Can you still hear me in back, Eric? Yeah. Whoever sits in back is, the back is back, is the doorkeeper. So if people come in late, you have to usher them, right? It's a comfortable chair, right? Yeah, so that's a special chair. It'll be fixed. Yeah. Of course, usually when we think about healing, we're thinking about emotional, mental, physical healing, and that's definitely a big part of medicine Buddha practice. But most of the healing that I'm involved in or that we're doing here at Lionsoar is the healing of reconciliation, otherwise like getting along with others. So the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas are known as peacemakers, as people that are willing to get into the middle of things and help sides balance and reconcile and find the middle way. When we're just doing healing just for ourselves alone, that's important, because if we're all screwed up and unhealthy, generally we can't be of that much benefit. But in our Bodhisattva practice, one of the biggest benefits is resolving conflict and healing things on an environmental and social level. Good, Eric, thank you, you're on it. That's good. Jumped right up. So that's good. This is very traditional. At the monastery, they just call you out, you know, and it doesn't, you know, doesn't work. And on the West, we don't like to do that. We just like to sit there and it's being like called out at a movie theater. But this is what happens at the monastery. Lionsoar Dharma Center and the temple here are a grand experiment because we are doing traditional practices with many of the traditional rituals and precepts, also in a very modern way. So it's very much a complete blend. Sometimes the blend tastes sweet, sometimes a little bitter, but it is a blend of very traditional Asian Dharma and very American Dharma. For example, of course, in Asia wouldn't be sitting in comfortable chairs, right? There wouldn't be gender mix, right? Probably all the men would be sitting in front and the women would be sitting in back and running around getting tea or something, right? And we're doing things in English, and we're taking questions and answers. We're having discussion that doesn't happen in traditional. So we have, you know, the way we're doing things is very actually innovative. For some people, we're a little bit too high church, like they just want to sit and no ritual. But the model here is we're doing both things at the same time. But sometimes that's why I have to call out and say, okay, Eric's the one in the back. That's traditional. There's someone who was caring for guests and people that walk in. So the healing that I'm interested in today is conflict resolution. You know, how as bodhisattvas, as wisdom beings, aspiring Buddhas, we can be part of the process of reconciliation. I used to belong to a peace group called about reconciliation, that said motto was, there's no way to peace, peace is the way, like that. Fellowship of Reconciliation. Maybe it's not so big in California, but the Buddhist Peace Fellowship that Eiken Roshi and Nelson Roshi started in the 80s, that I was a board member for a while, is part of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. That's part of the, everything okay? Yeah, all right, good. The monastery, sometimes like a traditional temple, sometimes the Lama will just correct rituals right in the middle. Like that, somebody will be doing something and they'll say, no, put it over here or put it over there, right? So in our tradition, everything is always kind of a balance. So the Buddha or the Lama will sometimes say, you know, go to the right. And then sometimes we'll say, go to the left. So Jack Kornfield from Spirit Rock, you know, tells a story, you know, about his teacher, Achan Cha, who was an abbot. And he, like any abbot, like me, gets complaints all the time. And people are saying, you know, Achanji, you know, sometimes you just, I don't get it. You don't give correct dharma. Sometimes you tell people to go this direction, then you do the opposite, you know. How can that be the Buddha's teaching? And he said, well, it's like this. I see you walking down the road, and when you start veering off to the ditch in the left, I say, go right. And when I see you veering off to that ditch on the right, you say, go left, right? So all the teachings are like that. We're really interested in this case, driving down the middle of the road, which is actually how they drive in India, by the way. So, <there's> a, yeah. So, in India, it's like there. Usually no lanes. You know, brand new modern freeways that actually have lanes, but you just honk, and then there's, you know, like chicken, and there's this whoosh of air as, you know, the car just goes by. You're driving on the left, you know. So they drive down the middle, and then when you see another vehicle coming, then you just move over, you know. So it's a real metaphor in India. Uh-oh, Eric, there you go. He's going to stay busy. This is really good. So the reconciliation theory comes from just right from the Buddha, which is we're here to manifest and embody and wake up to the middle way, which is one way of saying interdependence, which is another way of saying emptiness. These terms are all like describe little, just, they don't describe different things, they're just different words. This is important in Dharma because people get, there sometimes are different things, but many times they're not different things. So the chair doesn't change when you call it, you know, by French or German, right? Same thing. So in our tradition, when we want to point out something from something that doesn't exist as solid from its side, we or independent from its side, we say emptiness. When we want to point out things from the standpoint of a path, you know, we say middle way. When we want to point out things from the sense of, you know, correct relative truth, we'll say interdependence. But saying the same thing, basically. So here at the temple, like, that's the middle way, interdependence, and emptiness, because we're practicing both traditional Vajrayana style from the Himalayan regions in India, and we're also doing, you know, 21st century modern style, also middle way. And we bring in teachers that are interested in that too. Of course, Jada Rinpoche and Kenshin Rinpoche, but also people had a chance to meet Venerable Tenzin Choki, you know, very studied nun who is here. Was that just last month? Yeah. And then we're having Venerable Thupten Chodron, the abbess at Sarasti Abbey, coming sometime next year. So like me, they're trying to, you know, like do traditional Dharma, do all the correct trainings, and practice within an environment that someone's coming in now. That's great. Maybe Eric will just stand at the door. You know, that's kind of... oh, that's good. So the process of reconciliation is based upon the middle way path. It's based on not holding on to I'm right and you're wrong. Yeah, it's based on seeing that we all have a fundamental connection. So that's explaining it from three different ways, right? So reconciliation is we're not just holding on to like my position only, you know, is right and I'm going to win and you're going to die and I'm going to live. Mm-hmm. It's not just based on, so that's emptiness. It's not just based on the fundamental recognition that things are inherently balanced and that when we act and realize that balance, then we're happy and free. And then it's finally based on a sense always of, you know, mutual connection. That it may look like you're not connected with anybody. It may look like, you know, I don't want anything to do with that person, or I, you know, that means nothing to me, or something like that. But actually, once they come into your field of perception, you're sunk, right? Because you're connected. So, right? So we know even from modern science that the colors we see here, colorful, they don't exist inherently in the rug or the wall or the paintings, right? At least we can acknowledge that, right? We have the rhizomes and, I don't know, maybe an ophthalmologist is here or could explain better, but, you know, the brain puts together. You know, we never know enough neuroscience now that the brain puts together that's a certain color. And the brain also puts together that's a door, and the mind, you know, does that. So it's once I see the rug or the door or you, we're already connected. There's no backing out from that, right? But if we recognize that that is not a fixated position, that that position is flowing, that position is open, that that position is doable, then we have a path, we have a middle way. I'm currently reading, you know, two books on conflict resolution. That's how I like to read things. So they're slightly different style, you know, like two books at the same time. It's a kind of monastic debate style. So the way to read books on emptiness philosophically is you read one from Shentong Rantong. So different views of emptiness, right? You should be reading Taranatha and you know, Tsongkhapa. Sorry, words, but you know, two different people at the same time, right? You know, like that. You know, so little slightly interpretations, right? Otherwise, you're just reading. Okay, Tsongkhapa's right. They're wrong, you know, wrong. You know, you're not doing any critical thinking, right? You know, we think, you know, because of Western education that we're doing critical thinking when we're just kind of reading one thing. But actually, you should always be reading like something that's a little bit opposite, right? So, you know, we technically, we do Heart Sutra. So we should also be reading, you know, something that says there is a self, you know, there, you know, like that. In fact, in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, you know, the Buddha said, since I'm about ready to go, I just thought I'd lay this on you. There is a self. There is permanence, you know, like, and, you know, some of the arhats' heads blew up, you know. So So sometimes we will say there is a self, and sometimes we'll say no self, because these are teaching words or turning words, right? If this little test, with some people here have done the Buddhist Fundamentals course, Foundations of Buddhist Thought, so they shouldn't answer, we should let other people answer, but if we go looking for no self, will we find it? Will we find the no self? No. If we go looking for the self, will we find it? No. But does that mean we're then nihilist, that nothing exists? No, not either. So we take the middle way, that emptiness and appearance arise simultaneously. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Emptiness or complete openness, the nature of mind is form and formless at the same time. Usually people are on one side or the other, aren't they? They usually go, okay, I get emptiness, it's formless, you can't see it, you know, it's inscrutable, inconceivable. And then what do you do with, you know, what do you do with this thing, right? Then you have a problem, right, attached to one side. Then the other people go, no, the phenomenal world is it, you know. It's just about, you know, things. It's just about body. It's just about brain. It's just about brain chemistry, you know. It's, you know, just about what we can see and measure. The Dalai Lama gave a really good book, Universe in a Single Atom. Anybody been reading that, you know? where he's very interested in the subject. How do we talk about mind and phenomena, and how do they work together? Maybe we need to read that in book clubs and things. So the healing is important when we're talking about medicine Buddha practice, that we not become conventional. Conventional kind of healer types. Conventional healing would be, you know, I, very solid me, just want to get rid of my, you know, solid whatever that is, you know, so we just turn it into propitiating some kind of Buddha deity to remove a very solid thing. So if we have that, if you think, well, I'm a solid self, existing independently from my side, propitiating an outside God or Buddha who's, you know, supposed to remove some outside thing that's solid and exists from its own side, then we're doing very conventional healing, which is fine in a way, you know. So when I go see my Kaiser doctor, we're not really talking about emptiness, middle way, or interdependence, you know, we're just talking about my blood pressure, and we're staying very rational. But, you know, we use the kind of fiction of objective reality to then prescribe, you know, the right medicine, but we don't take it as, it's just relative, we don't take it as absolute truth. So actually I like my doctor Kaiser, I should say that. But then generally when I go see the doctor at Kaiser, Sabrina always comes with me. She's a nurse. So the doctor now is fully trained. Because it's good, you know, if you know the medical terminology, you're going to get better treatment, right? So if you don't have a wonderful nurse to go with you, then we should learn a little bit terminology. We shouldn't just go, I don't know. You know, we should learn. It's our responsibility. So that's also one side. So a little bit, my doctor's really sweet. He goes, sometimes I just have a little, you know, skin rash or something like that. And he goes, oh, I think this little maybe psoriasis or something is caused from stress, but you're a meditation master, you know, that's what I do. so you shouldn't have any stress. Okay. Well, you just made it worse. No, but that. So, okay. So that's making the mind solid, right? And that's making the illness solid, right? There isn't a Lama, a Rinpoche, a Mahasiddha that doesn't have some kind of, physical illness. There's sometimes really weird mythology about that, on a fundamental level, our Buddha nature, yes, not ill, always healthy, but every teacher that has nirmanakaya, manifestation body, is going to have something going on, right? The Buddha had a bad back. The Buddha used to complain, died of maybe some stomach trouble or something, right? So every teacher is going to have some physical problem. So sometimes that's explained away like the teacher is sick because they're taking on the illness of other people. That can be done. It's kind of weird. That's another story. But usually not. It's just there's a lot of smoke in the air. So we're just interdependent with the situation, right? And, we show up, so it's smoky. So you got respiratory, it isn't like your Buddha nature is off, so like that, right? So in our healing practices, we always look at it's not solid on either side, mind or body. It's a relational issue, right? It's, that's kind of trite. We say mind-body, but we really have to be clear. And then in our treatment and what we do, we try to take the middle way. We try to reconcile the inner conflict. If someone's mad about their illness, does it help resolve the illness? It doesn't, If we're mad at somebody else all the time, we're not going to reconcile or feel good inside. So in our model, we take these three realization supports that things are empty of being solid on their own side, empty of, being like independent of each other. So they're connected. That's called interdependence, or pratityasamutpada in Sanskrit. And the treatment is the middle way, bringing people to connect, bringing them into balance, bringing the situation to resolution. So when I worked at the hospitals, and even now, you're supposed to have a treatment plan. So the treatment plan should always have the language, patient should learn independent living skills as evidenced by, being able to drive themselves to their appointment, right? Something like that. So that's a middle way, right? That's an interchange between the client and the environment, right? So we're always looking for, in healing, for that interchange. We're always looking for what the person who's ill can do for themselves and what we can do for them. So when people come to Darshan for instruction, I would say, well, what training are you doing? Which is your yogic training, kind of on the cushion, and what are your realizations and obstacles? So you present something, and then the Lama, you start a dialogue. That makes sense, right? So there's always a participation quality. You always present something. Like medical model, which I kind of like sometimes, when you're in treatment team, you say, what's the patient's chief complaint, right? So you have to show up with something. Always show up for healing like, this is what I'm working on, this is what I'm doing, because then that brings it out into the open, brings it out into the middle way, and then you start a dialogue. This is a very important healing model, because usually we just say, please, Lama, please, physician, you know, just make it go away. Why is that not the middle way? Because we haven't first presented. So if you really want to do correct medicine, Buddha, that's why we do first prayers. We put something out there and we present something like, this is what I'm doing. And then it starts the dialogue with the healing energy. Or the healing energy results as a part of the dialogue between the absolute, our complete truth world of healing, the healing Buddha, and your personal situation. If you want to understand how the sadhanas work, why in our tradition we do, prayers to idealized bodhisattvas like we see on the walls and the tankas, is because we're always engaging in that interdependent dialogue. That makes sense, right? So that's the middle way. And through that, we come to healing. So when we come to Medicine Buddha, if you come to do the practice, take the initiation, see the sand mandala, always bring something with you that you want to have accomplished, and that you're able to, talk about your, use medical terminology, talk about the symptoms. That's where Sabrina has really been good for me. Like, I know the psych world, but, if you can rattle off quickly, these are the physical symptoms, doesn't it help the physician, right? If you just go, well, I don't know what's wrong with me, then the doctor has to constantly ask you questions, right? And, of course, if it's Kaiser, there's 15 minutes. So I should lay off on Kaiser, but... That's a doing center. Yeah, so we'll... Yeah. We need more docs, okay. So, but if you're... the doctor and the psychologist, therapist has to ask lots of questions, it slows down, right? So the healing happens when we bring something forth. You even see this in the Bible with, people approaching Jesus. They said, this is happening with me. And Jesus says, what's wrong with you, you see? And it starts a dialogue, and then the healing happens. It doesn't just magically happen like they show up and we're healed, right? There's always a dialogue. So if we present our symptoms, then our inner physician, the Medicine Buddha, can respond better. I've said it three times, right? So that's traditional. Like, why do lamas always say things three times? That's just traditional. So we're going to, take a break, and then stretch, and then do... short meditation, and then have some time for questions, and then I'd like to greet people at the end. That makes sense, right? So stretch a little bit. And Eric's still in charge of the door. Okay. Take a few minutes, then I'll ring the bell. Want to ride, and then I didn't see it. Okay, that's an important, really important piece. I'm not going to talk more about that, but you will notice, what's happening when the need arises, when you notice arising. In some traditions, and kind of beginning Dharma, we're said, don't have any attachments, put down desire, that's going to cause you trouble. Then, don't have any needs, right? There's some people that think, okay, nirvana means not having any needs. And maybe in some tradition that's true. But in our Tantra tradition, we use the energy of needs to come to realization. Oh, I needed my bicycle, and then I saw that it wasn't there. If I hadn't had the need, I wouldn't have seen the non-existence, right? So this is very important, but maybe next time I'll talk on that. So in Tantra, we don't try to eliminate desire and needs. We try to realize the fundamental wisdom quality of what's happening. You know, usually, of course, people over-exaggerate the needs, and they do over-exaggerate the object, and the need isn't clear. So we're not trying to get rid of desire. We're not trying to get rid of needs. We're bringing them to realization. That's the Vajrayana path. So now my yogis have returned from break. And this is like traditional monastery thing. Like, you don't say anything, and like then you kind of give them a hard time. Okay. So traditional practice too, after a lama gives a talk, is we're not trying to do formless meditation practice. We can, but it's also possible to just contemplate the teachings. You know, it's okay to do a narrative like, well, what did lama mean by needs? And, you know, so thinking's allowed in our meditative tradition too. It's just we want you thinking about dharma. We don't necessarily want you thinking about, you know, what you're, you know, going to do, you know, next week for a vacation, right? Okay. We're going to do, like, can we do 12 minutes? All right. So you won't freak out. We can all do 12 minutes a day. How many people can pledge to do 12 minutes a day, no matter what? Yeah. You just did it, so you're covered for Sunday. Yeah. Extra credit, you can do more. Yeah. So I have time for some questions, discussions, comments, and complaints. So Dana's moving with, or Doug, okay. Yeah. With the mic, we get the questions too, right? Recorded, yeah.
So I was thinking about what you were talking about in terms of conflict resolution.
Yeah.
And so if you have two parties, right, who are in conflict of more or less seriousness, if there's a way for them both to recognize, you know, the emptiness, that it's just not solid.
Yeah.
So when that's fine if you're talking like I'm talking to Peter or something. But what about when I'm talking to somebody who like knows nothing about Dharma, has never heard of emptiness, has no idea of not solid? What do you do then?
Well, we're always talking about three things, really. You know, something standpoint of emptiness, not unfindability, not solid, not rigid, existing from its outside. Then we're always talking about interdependence or connection, and then we're always talking about balance and middle way. So those three are always going together. So if we're emphasizing a little bit the emptiness style, like, you know, both of you are a little bit, you know, too fixated, or let's just open up, guys. Maybe that doesn't work. So you're going to talk more about how they're connected rather than, you know, how they disagree. And then you're going to, it doesn't feel good to be out of balance, actually. So much of Dharma and conflict resolution is getting parties to admit that it's painful. You know, so first noble truth, truth is suffering. So when we're out of balance, when we're not seeing the complete open nature of awareness, then it's slightly painful. And usually we do have to draw people's attention to that it's painful, like that. Or we have to draw attention to their connection, which in most cases is drawing attention to people's you know, mutual needs. You know, you're talking about needs then. And it's kind of high level, but it happens every once in a while that people see that their anger, their confusion isn't solid, and there's some laughter, you know, like that. There are actually sometimes people just, you know, yeah, you know, even when there's high, you know, high conflict couples and couple therapy, you know, sometimes there's actually, you know, some laughter or some groundlessness, as, you know, Pema Chodron likes to say, that happens. And but because if people haven't done any Dharma practice or stabilization, then the situation re-solidifies very quickly. You know, but we can get a little wedge in there, like that. So those three styles, you know, we're always using in Dharma, you know, complete open nature of awareness, then the balance piece that feels blissful to be in balance, basically, and then the needs or interconnection style. In our tradition, we very much emphasize the harmony of bliss and wisdom, like that. So wouldn't it feel better if you guys worked it out, you know, like that, that approach? Yeah, good question. Yes, sir.
I have a stupid question.
Oh, good. These are the best. Everyone's going, thank God.
Why Medicine Buddha instead of, I mean, you know, I already practiced Vajrasattva, Green Tara, Guru Rinpoche, Balakiteshvara, Amitabha? What do I need medicine Buddha for?
This is not a stupid question. That's a good question, of course. The answer is you don't. you know, so there's a phrase in Tibetan that Tibetans would say, in India they practiced one Buddha Deva and accomplished them all. In Tibet we practiced 1,000 and accomplished none. You know, so my version of that is the best practice is the one you actually do. It's all because of, like, you know, karmic connection. You know, if we feel, okay, that the way the story of that Buddha Deva or that color or that the way that is, or maybe the teacher I got the initiation from, you know, that resonates. So I'm doing it, you know. But all the Buddhas have, you know, the same qualities ultimately, you know. A lot of times it is confusing in the West because in Tantra there's so many different practices and tools. Just like it's confusing, there's so many different, you know, psychotropic meds, you know, and so many different psychotherapy styles that the tendency is like, I just want to follow my breath and, you know, like that. But they all have actually the same essence. However, there is there's somewhat of a hierarchy in our tradition, so that even though we're doing different practices, we are, if we're dedicated students, going to be encouraged to do Mahamudra Dzogchen practice. That sounds easy, but it's hard. You know, a practice that absolutely has no reference point whatsoever, you know, other than pure awareness. So that sounds easy, but we'll see. Maybe it is easy for some people. If we're practicing that, we're, of course, practicing and accomplishing all. And, you know, other people have been brought to complete Buddhahood just by doing a Kriya Yoga practice like Tara or something like that. So generally in our tradition, we like people to be acquainted with the different practices just so you have the skillful means to, you know, help others too. It isn't just for us. But generally, we're going to settle down into, like, you know, a few core practices. I don't think there's a day in 40 years I haven't done Vajrasattva. You know, there's just, I'm just going to do it. You know, that's it, you know. You know, it's not a decision like, should I do it or not? You know, it's just like brushing your teeth or something. I'm going to really drill down on that. You know, it's one example. Yeah. Good question. Aren't you glad Dirk asked that question? You know, so that's like, okay, we have time for maybe a little bit. One more. You had a hand up in the back, someone. Yeah, okay, you're on.
And I do have a speaking question.
Oh, good, another two. That's a really good day, yeah. So,
I'm kind of new to this practice, mm-hmm. and I hear the term dharma used a lot, mm-hmm. and I don't know what it means.
Oh, that is a good question. So, if my DJ was here, or Lama Zopa was here, like you'd all be sitting here for another 3 hours. You don't want to be here for 3 hours? Oh, okay. Shucks, you know, okay. So I like using the term Dharma because I don't like saying Buddhism, because that's a Western affectation, as if, you know, it's an ism. So Dharma, oops. Dharma can mean Sanskrit wise it, you know, some people, the gloss on it, should I stop? Yeah. you know, depending on what Sanskrit is, which is Tibetan or Indian, but Dharma, you know, lots of times means just support. But it's also come to mean truth, the truth. So when we say Buddha Dharma, we're you know, identifying it a little bit with Shakyamuni's tradition. But, you know, Dharma can mean things too, like phenomena can be dharmas. Or Dharma can be like, what's your livelihood? You know, you could say, what's your Dharma? What do you do? Like that. So it's kind of akin to like saying the Tao in Chinese, I guess. The truth, the way, things as they are, realization. So could be Dharma with a small d, that could be very, you know, relative things, or it could be absolute truth. The Sanskrit for like things as they are, absolute, is dharmata. You get a little Sanskrit lesson today. So like shunya means like empty or hollow. So the state of being empty or hollow is shunyata. So that's why we say emptiness. You know, that's the ness is our kind of ta, like that. So you have dharmata, like that. Tathagata, you know, things like that. Dharma. So we say Dharma Center here. We're probably going to put up a sign that says a Buddhist temple and tradition of Dalai Lama, because, of course, not everyone knows that Dharma. But some words are not, it's nice not having it totally translated, right? Sometimes, Dharma. It also emphasizes that, you know, the real connection, you know, in India of all the yogic practices. So I like to emphasize that, you know, we're not, the tradition, the yoga traditions that came from India, of which Buddha Dharma is one, you know, share very essential qualities, right? So it's nice to say Dharma. And our technical practice here is, we say, Anattara Tantra Yoga. So we do yoga. That's what we're doing. That makes sense, right? So the yoga can be Sanskrit translated as, you know, connection. We say in Tibetan, Naljor, which means resting or returning or joining with the natural state. Like that. So, but we do yoga practice. It isn't just the folks in the Hatha yoga traditions, you know, around town that do yoga. We're, you know, we do yoga, right? Yeah. Yoga and Dharma, very important, very wide. Okay, so thank you. That was a good question. Oh, no, out of time. No, okay, one last one. Just.
I was going to explain that in Sanatana Dharma, it means the path of enlightenment.
Sanatana, like?
Sanatana Dharma means path of enlightenment. So in some traditions, Dharma means enlightenment. So it's the path of enlightenment as well.
Could be, yeah. Theravada tradition says Sanata, right? Like eternal Dharma, like that, right? Yeah, sometimes translated eternal. Yeah, thank you. Good, another scholar here. All right, let's do closing prayers.
Most magical display of the awareness of all the glorious ones. fiduciary, master of flawless wisdom, Vajrapani, destroyer of the entire host of Mars, Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the swimmer and sages, Losamdrapa, I make request at your holy feet.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. Yeah, Peter says nice things in the beginning, doesn't he? Nice welcoming. That's nice, don't you think? And Susan said nice things about Dana Paramita, I think, right? So, kind of traditionally, sometimes lamas like sit in their seat and people just come up to say hello for, you know, like quick hello or make an offering. And then the teacher goes back to their kind of room. And then you have opportunity for kind of like group meeting, you know. So that's very traditional too. So you might come in, and so you don't have total confidentiality, privacy, and privilege, right? You know, you're just, if you ask something, then everyone's listening, right? But that's really traditional, like that. So if people want individual, like just one-on-one private, then that's always scheduled with a teacher, right? You know, like that. Otherwise, you know, you just kind of have, you know, kind of public or small group. That's understandable, right? You know, and in monastery situations in India, as the people have been there, you know, Mike and Susan, other people contest. There's not a lot of alone time. You know, you just want to, if you find alone time, you're just kind of going, oh, wow, you know. But that's okay, you know, I'm sitting back in the library office and Patty or Dana can take you back. And then you just say hi and that's fine. You're with others. That's okay, right? Okay, that's interdependence, right? Okay, so I'm going to just sit here for a while. You can get up and go out or say hi. Thank you again, Om Mahong. Yeah.